The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily and sometimes more than daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Today, the Prime Minister was hauled in front of the Liaison Committee for the first time, made up of select committee chairs. They grilled him for just under 2 hours on a range of topics, including his number 10 advisor Dominic Cummings' trip to Durham during lockdown. Here are a few highlights of the session.
I'm asking specifically about your advice to parents who have COVID. The reason that you are not giving, the reason you are ducking it, the reason you're trying to...
I don't think that you're actually...
...across the country, even though it may mean them having to go into a hospital somewhere else where they may seed further infections. Do you want them to do that? Or do you want them to stay put when they don't have local childcare, like around a quarter of parents?
Yvette, I think you'd have to look at each individual case, and there were particular circumstances that my advisor explained. I think what Jenny Harris was trying to say was that where there are exceptional difficulties, then people needed to take account of them. Other than that, I don't really know what I can add.
No, here's the problem, Prime Minister. The reason you are ducking this is because the reason you're not giving people a straight answer is because you are trying to protect Dominic Cummings. The reason you've sent all of your ministers out to say fudgy things and unclear things is because you are trying not to incriminate Dominic Cummings and you don't want to apologise for him. The problem is that means you are putting your political concerns ahead of clear public health messages to parents who have coronavirus.
Pick up that social justice point and ask a question about a couple in my constituency. They both work, they have two children. The husband's employer didn't put him on the job retention scheme, so he has zero income. His wife is still working, but her income is less than their household rent. They have leave to remain in the UK, but no recourse to public funds, so they can't get any help at all. Isn't it wrong that a hard-working, law-abiding family like that is being forced by the current arrangements into destitution?
Hang on, Stephen. Why aren't they eligible for universal credit or employment support allowance
It's a very good question. It's because they have no recourse to public funds. That's a condition that's attached to their leave to remain. They've been here for years. Their children have been born in the UK. But because for a 10-year period, they have this no recourse to public funds, at the moment, they can get no help at all.
Where are they actually from?
The couple I'm thinking of are from Pakistan, but it applies to anyone.
Okay.
From outside the UK.
They can't get furloughed, obviously. Well, look, I'm going to have to come back to you on that, Stephen, okay. Because, you know, clearly they're people who've worked hard for this country, who live and work here, should have a support of one kind or another. But you've raised a very, very important point. If people's the condition of their leave to remain is they should have no recourse to public funds. I will find out how many there are in that position, and we will see what we can do to help.
How much do you think having women in the room when decisions are being made actually changes the nature of those decisions?
I think you make a huge difference, to be honest. I mean, that may sound like a vaguely sexist thing to say, but it's very important.
Prime Minister, you made the distinction between there being a lot of women and enough women. How many is enough?
Oh boy, that's a question on which I'm not competent to pronounce.
Is it not 50%?
Not a joking matter, though, is it?
James, to start us off, I think it's fair to say quite a few of the select committee chairs were probably hoping to catch the Prime Minister out when it came to the Dominic Cummings trip. Do you think they managed it in this session?
So I think before this session started, Boris Johnson's allies were most worried about the common questions on Dominic Cummings. They feared something that would keep the story moving for another day. This story is obviously doing damage to the government. You just need to look at the opinion polls to see that. I think in the end, that section wasn't actually particularly damaging for Boris Johnson, in part because several of the MPs questioning him about Dominic Cummings, particularly Pete Wishart, chose to give kind of long speeches rather than asking questions. You know, Meg Hillier, the chairman of the Public Accounts Committee, she asked a kind of short, sharp question, basically asking if Boris Johnson had seen the kind of evidence on his telephone that Boris Johnson, that Dominic Cummings referred to in his press conference on Monday, that showed where he was during his time in Durham. And Boris Johnson said he had. Meg Hillier then said, well, are you going to show that to the cabinet secretary? And Boris Johnson said, well, I think the kind of cabinet secretary has his hands full with this crisis at the moment. But that was the only question I think really discomforted Boris Johnson on Dominic Cummings. But then I think later in the session, Boris Johnson had some difficulties. I mean, the liaison committee is a hard session for a prime minister because you've got people who are select committee chairs and therefore kind of experts in the field who can ask you about anything. But there was a rather surprising moment when Boris Johnson didn't seem to know about this government policy of no recourse to public funds, which is that people are allowed to stay in the UK, but they are not allowed to call on the UK welfare system. And I think it's quite clear from that, from the session today, that Boris Johnson didn't know that that was the case. He kept asking Stephen Timms, who asked him about this, why these constituents of his were not applying for universal credit. And I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson's reaction to being told that they weren't allowed to suggests that there is probably going to be a government U-turn coming on this fairly soon.
Mm. And Katie, on that point on the change to the welfare system, do you think that's down a bit to a lack of preparation from the Prime Minister?
Yeah, potentially. I think, look, sometimes when you say things so many times, they begin to sound a bit like a cliche, but it is the case that Boris Johnson is seen to have a weakness when it comes to details. It's why at Prime Minister's questions against Keir Starmer, Boris Johnson allies are particularly worried in advance, and why he seems to struggle more, and because you have someone who is into lots of details. So having a lengthy session before the liaison committee, I think, does A, expose it in the sense that you have to be very laser focused for quite a long period of time on questions on lots of different things. But secondly, I think it can expose, you know, a lack of grasp on things. So I think the recourse to public funds was probably the most surprising moment of the committee appearance. I think that raised the most eyebrows. I think there were other few things where it felt as though the Prime Minister, you know, I think there were points when he said he would come back to people. And I actually think, even though that suggested he didn't have all the information, I think that was understandable to a degree. I think it was when it was clear that he just didn't seem to know anything about this area, or he had a misunderstanding of it, that it was, you know, particularly striking.
I thought it was interesting that you saw Boris Johnson admit publicly, and this is only the first time the government has acknowledged this publicly rather than kind of privately or off the record, but the UK hadn't learned the lessons of SARS and MERS, and that was one of the reasons why it had been so ill-prepared for COVID-19, that it had a kind of national pandemic plan that was designed to deal with flu rather than a SARS-style disease. I thought that was quite interesting, but I think you also see, though, that this kind of this willingness to admit error is quite limited, because Hugh Merriman asked a question, Chairman of Transport Committee, asked a question which kind of does follow logically, which is, if it was wrong to introduce quarantine in February before community transmission had started in the UK, why is it right to introduce quarantine next month when the UK hopes that community transmission here will have stopped? You know, it's hard to see how the policy would have been wrong in February but right from June the 8th. Boris Johnson was still trying to claim that there were two different situations, and that it wouldn't have been the right thing to have imposed quarantine in February, when the fact that his government is going to impose quarantine from June the 8th suggests that it would have been the right thing in February. And I think this quarantine problem is going to become a problem for the government, in that there are lots of Tory MPs who are unhappy about it, who see it as intellectually inconsistent, worried that it will retard the economic recovery, that it will particularly hurt the tourism sector. And they also think that voters won't like it as the summer goes on. People will want to be able to go to somewhere with more guaranteed sunshine than Britain has even in the summer months. And that, you know, people will wonder why they're not allowed to fly to a country like Greece that has very few coronavirus cases, and then come back to the UK without having to isolate for 2 weeks afterwards, something that essentially makes a kind of short summer holiday impossible.
And Casey, I think with that policy and in more general, do you think sort of the government is hemming itself in slightly by refusing to admit to mistakes like that?
I think potentially. I think that ultimately we are still expecting there to be an eventual public inquiry. I do think the government is getting more prepared to say, oh, we would have done things differently. And it was interesting, slightly going back to the issue of Dominic Cummings, when he gave his own personal press conference on Bank Holiday Monday, you had Dominic Cummings talking about how he thought he had made mistakes in the past in government, and he seemed to be referring specifically to the coronavirus response. So I do think we're going to get more of this from the government in the coming, you know, months as things go on. But there are some areas where I think, particularly when they're enforcing policy still, they don't want to admit things.
We've also seen today, James, that the government is going to begin its test and tracing program tomorrow. Did you get the sense from the liaison committee that it's going to be sort of running at full capacity at the moment and everything is sort of is ready to go?
Yeah, look, I think the government ideally would be launching this alongside the much heralded mobile phone app, because by kind of automating huge amounts of contact tracing, it kind of makes things a lot easier and a lot quicker. But the app isn't ready yet, and we still haven't, I don't think, Katie, correct me when I go wrong, but I still don't think we have a release date for this app when people outside the Isle of Wight are going to be able to download it and put it on their phones. This is obviously the UK government's solution for getting out of it. The hope is that it will allow it not to have to resort to the kind of sledgehammer option of a national lockdown in future, but instead they'll be able to say, right, this particular suburb has got a problem, so we're going to start closing down schools and non-essential retail there and locking people down. And so you basically limit the economic pain to the country, because it's one particular place that is locked down rather than the whole of the UK.
Yeah, I think on the app we don't have a specific date. I have to say, when you mention the phone app to some figures in government, you do get the sense people are getting quite defensive over it. But I think that one of the things I have heard a few times now when figures in government are trying to explain why there is not going to be an app accompanying this is that the app was never essential when it comes to the system of test and trace. In a way, I think they want to suggest it was almost the cherry on the cake, you know, the icing on the cake. But I think another thing, though, which has come back is, and it goes back to something that came up at the liaison committee, so Boris Johnson was asked in various ways, ultimately, how do you get the public to go along with test and trace? Because ultimately we're entering a situation where you could get a call and just be told you need to self-isolate for 2 weeks. And are people really going to do that? It might be that you were in a shop and you saw someone and someone says you now have to stay indoors for 2 weeks. Some on the committee were trying to then link that to Dominic Cummings and suggesting that would make it even harder. But when you're looking specifically at test and trace in the programme, one of the things that they found from the Isle of Wight study and other research they are doing is people are much more likely, according to their research, to listen to instruction to stay at home for 2 weeks if they have someone on the phone telling them than if they get a message on an app.
And it's also interesting that on kind of Katie's kind of moral authority point there, it's also going to be that the NHS wants you to stay at home. They clearly think that is will be more effective in getting people to follow the advice than saying the government or your local authority instructs you to stay home. Then it's going to be the NHS wants you to stay home.
And we also saw Boris Johnson sort of pressed by Jeremy Hunt on the time it takes for tests to come back. I think Hunt was making the point that it should be 48 hours. It's 48 hours at the moment. It should probably down to 24 hours. How much do you think that is linked to the test and trace programme being successful?
Yeah, obviously, the longer you have to wait for the test results, the less effective it's going to be, because the longer it is until you can say, right, that person has definitely got coronavirus. We need to track down all the people that they've been in contact with for more than 15 minutes at a distance of less than 2 metres apart. I thought it was quite interesting that you could see Boris Johnson almost committed kind of news on that front. He said, yeah, there's a target of getting it down to 24 hours. And then when Jeremy Hunt pressed for what the deadline for meeting that target was, Boris Johnson said, "Oh no, I'm not putting any more deadlines on targets. I've been told not to do that." And I think you can tell that although this is the government's aim, they're not certain of when they will be able to hit that target.
Katie, we also saw the Prime Minister get into maybe a slightly tough situation with Caroline Noakes about the representation of women in terms of in terms of the top of government. How do you think he managed there?
Yes, I think this is where the Prime Minister looked fairly uncomfortable. A, it was a slightly funny setup to begin with, because Caroline Noakes and Boris Johnson have history in the sense that she is one of the MPs he withdrew the whip from over Brexit. And so there's, you know, I think there's little love lost there. And then you had Caroline Noakes pressing the Prime Minister on a few different questions relating to gender. Initially, he seemed to not quite have the answer to her first question, but I think that the point when he looked the most uncomfortable or really trying to think carefully about his words was when she went back to previous comments he'd made about having enough women in cabinet but you could have more, and tried to get him to define how many women was enough, at which point he seemed to try and backtrack and joke around a bit. Then that created a slightly awkward situation because everyone said, oh, gender's actually very important, you shouldn't be laughing. And as far as we can tell, the Prime Minister almost ended the exchange by telling Caroline Noakes that she had the potential to be the third female Prime Minister the UK's ever had. So I don't know if she quite got the answer she wanted, but she did get something of a pep talk.
It's one way to butter up the committee. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.